The Southeastern Conference took a major step last week when it announced that its schools can begin welcoming athletes back onto campus for workouts beginning on June the 8th. But is the SEC really prepared to do enough testing to make sure that its athletes are safe?
It's really important that we not assume that a set of conference guidelines are actually all that will be done on our campuses.
That is SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey, and he joins me today to discuss how the league arrived at its plans, how it will execute those plans, and what the path looks like moving forward, hopefully, to getting SEC football back onto our TV screens. I'm Seth Davis from The Athletic, and this is The Comeback, COVID-19 and the Return of Sports. We will get to Greg Sankey in a minute, but first, a quick roundup on the latest news around the world of sports. First, in the NBA, this week, we're expecting some more clarity on the league's return-to-play scenario. Shams Charania from The Athletic is reporting that the league is polling general managers to get their opinions on what the competition format should look like if and when the league gets back on the court. Some options to consider: resuming the regular season with all 30 teams, bringing back a smaller number of teams to figure out playoff standings, or going straight into a normal 16 playoff with or without a possible play-in tournament. Lots of details still to be ironed out, but in the meantime, more NBA teams are being allowed to open their practice facilities for small workouts, and that is good news. The NHL is also getting closer to allowing its athletes to practice again in team facilities in small groups, but back on the ice. Scott Burnside of The Athletic reports that the NHL has outlined safety protocols that would be required in order for teams to be able to take that step, looking towards a possible timetable of early June to begin those workouts. And finally, in the world of college basketball, Georgetown coach Patrick Ewing revealed late last week that he had been hospitalized for COVID-19. Lots of concern around the sports world for Ewing, but on Monday, his son, Patrick Jr., revealed that his pops is out of the hospital and recovering. We wish Patrick well. And now, my conversation with SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey about his league's announcement that it's allowing athletes back on campus, hopefully with an eye towards getting ready for a fall sports season. Greg Sankey, welcome to the Comeback Podcast. Let's get right to it. Explain to us exactly what the SEC's policy is that you all announced last week, and how did you arrive at the decision to go forward with this set of policies and procedures?
We made an announcement that looks forward to Monday, June 8th as the first day of a no earlier than date for student athletes to return to our athletic department facilities to begin the strength and conditioning part of their preparation this summer. It was a decision made after the NCAA Division I Council allowed voluntary activities to resume effective June 1st, actually. But we have had a medical advisory task force, return to athletic activity task force, looking at a wide array of issues around health concerns, around return to activity, around diagnosis, testing activities that are appropriate, along with our campuses who are for weeks and really months have been planning for the return of their student athletes. So all of those combined to essentially have us through our presidents and chancellors allow this opportunity June 8th, which gives a 2-week lead up time for oversight, communication, final preparations that will lead to the first step of student athletes being active again on our campuses.
Obviously, Greg, nothing is risk-free, especially in this current environment. What can you say about the risk involved in moving ahead with at least these workouts as an introductory phase to getting everybody back on the field and on the court?
We're all learning how to adjust and live in this COVID-19 environment, and nothing in life is risk-free. We know a few realities of our programs. One, they are contained environments. Second, they have built-in sports medicine experts, team doctors, physicians, athletic trainers, sports medicine specialists, and many of them have direct relationships either with university hospitals or with proximal hospitals who deal with health and safety issues every day. And so we have literally the best of the best across our footprint to help guide us in this effort. On the other hand, we have states that are opening. They do this on different timelines, but they're opening to allow physical activity, access to gyms. And rather than simply cast everyone to whatever circumstance they may find themselves in, wherever they reside, we believe there's an opportunity to mitigate, manage, oversee the risk, support in a really positive way the health of our student athletes through this initial step of opening our athletic facilities again.
So, Greg, the biggest concern that people have with this, of course, is the big issue of testing. As part of these protocols, you're saying that athletes should get tested on their way onto campus and then once they're on campus, but that doesn't include testing them moving forward once they're on campus unless they are showing symptoms. And as we all know, oftentimes people are asymptomatic for several days until they develop symptoms of the virus, but in the meantime, they can still transmit the virus. This is why, for example, Major League Baseball, their return to play plan, which they released last week, that includes testing all individuals multiple times per week. So what would you say to people who are concerned that that is not adequate and therefore you're running an unacceptable risk that somebody could be asymptomatic, not tested, but positive, and then spread the virus to a whole lot of his teammates?
Well, let's back up in the question and understand just a set of realities. As I indicated, we have relied on health professionals to guide our decision making, and our campuses will do the same. That's one important point. The second is we have watched decision making play out in different ways in local communities and across states over the last 60, 70, 80 days of this public health crisis. And so it's really important that we not assume that a set of conference guidelines are actually all that will be done on our campuses. In fact, our campuses are communicating, and that's why the lead-up time is important. They're communicating their preparation and their protocols on a local basis. And so we're not returning to play right now either. We are allowing a limited number of individuals on a voluntary basis to access weight facilities. And we can compare that to the alternative, which is we keep those closed and say to people, go wherever you want to, and relatively speaking, an unsupervised environment without the diagnostic oversight, without the continuity of attention that we'll be providing from a care standpoint on our campuses. So we have to set up what's actually happening against some of the observations about testing being the only way. Again, relying on health professionals, we've made these decisions, and our campuses are absolutely going further than conference guidelines. And we also understand that we've seen in our society the questions about reliability and access to testing. We know that will develop rapidly over the next weeks and months. And so we take a long view as we look at testing, that we're going to learn a great deal, and we're going to be prepared as we go further into the summer to support those protocols on our campuses, even as they're doing that come June 8th and likely before even.
And in fact, your colleague from the Big 12, Bob Bowlsby, the commissioner there, did say recently he's anticipating more and cheaper tests being available in the coming weeks and months. Right now, I've heard these figures, $50 to $100 a test. That's a lot of money that's going to add up. Is it your anticipation, Greg, that as things get moved forward closer to a season potentially starting, that you're going to have more cheaper tests?
Well, there's another word in there that has to be considered, and that's reliability. And we don't have the luxury, based on the information that's been shared with me, to assume that every test result is actually the correct test result. And we're learning collectively more and more about that reality. We invest a great deal in the health and safety support for our student athletes, and we'll do so around testing. Do I expect that availability and the economics will change? I do, but I'm not the one designing those tests. I'm not the one researching the reliability. But I think as we've seen, again, over the last 60, 70 days, particularly over the last 30 days, the availability of testing has increased. The methodology around testing has expanded, and I think we'll see the reliability, which has been a point of concern, be more and more accurate as we move into and through the summer.
The NCAA has declined to issue any specific uniform procedure. So we have variations between schools, variations between conferences. Would it be more helpful for you guys at the conference level if the NCAA had some stronger guidelines so you could ensure that not only was it being done properly, but uniformly across the country?
The NCAA is not alone in not being a national prescriber of protocols. We've seen that from governments at the federal level, states and locales having different expectations and standards. So what I think the NCAA has done is actually acknowledge that reality. I think that's an important anchor in this conversation. As we go through the summer and continue to talk among conference commissioners, my expectations will be more and more common expectations as we go back and think about testing availability and reliability. That will inform decision-making. And we're in a circumstance where we do have time to make some determinations. We get to see the continuing expansion of testing, the enhancement of reliability. Those realities will help inform that decision making. And candidly, I think the lack of a standard dictate right now at the national level is probably the most informed perspective. Whether it remains that way through the next 60, 70, 80, 90 days, we'll have to see.
A consistent conversation and debate, frankly, about whether you could have sports on any given campus without the students there, either all of the students or at least, you know, a good percentage of them participating on campus. Can you envision a scenario where you're having sports without students on campus? And could you envision a scenario where you're only having football and not other sports? Or when you talk about fall sports, are you talking about all or nothing?
I have avoided running down the trail of all the hypotheticals because the framing of those if and what if questions narrows whatever reality we may face. And right now in mid-late May, we don't have to make those decisions. We have to think about those realities. We don't have to make those decisions. My fundamental statement has been and will continue to be, our universities have to be back to operations as a first step in fostering the return of sports, football, soccer, volleyball, cross country for us in the fall. And we're seeing that happen literally right now. Our universities are getting back to activity as we learn how to live with the realities around COVID-19. The what ifs, the how does campus look? How do we adjust? What does that mean for students? All of those are to be answered questions. And I've avoided trying to predict because I think we'll have to adjust to the reality. I fully expect, based on the communications from our campuses, adjustments in the fall. So we've seen the adjustments of the academic calendar. I fully expect, like we've seen over the last 5 years, probably for the last decade, an increase in online delivery of courses. But I also expect the emphasis will be on residential learning, whatever that looks like. And those are the plans that are being made that will help us be prepared to answer the question as we move into the fall sports season.
All of us, of course, are under the assumption that, particularly with respect to football, we're talking about no fans in the stadium. It was interesting to read recently, Gene Smith, the athletic director at Ohio State, actually talked about potentially putting fans in their stadium, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000, whatever it may be. Has there been, and I realize this is a hypothetical, so obviously you're not going to commit either way, but has there been much conversation about fans in the stadium, or has nobody within the SEC or the conversations you have really willing to go there yet?
Well, sure, there's been conversation. There's been conversation that ranges the gamut. You know, as we look, Seth, at the conversation that's erupted in the narrative, you've seen like football season at one point, I read an article, was going to kick off in July of 2020. Well, I don't know who was talking about that hypothetical. And then there's the notion that, well, it could go all the way to June of 2021 if we kicked off at some point in the spring. And then there's the what happens with fans. So I think all of us are looking at scenarios. But again, it's mid-May. Those are decisions we don't have to make. We have to think forward. We have to think about what does game management look like? What does egress and ingress look like? What does the way we distribute tickets look like? And there are literally hundreds of elements. Part of the value right now in that, in using that time, is you're able to watch the last, what, 7-8 days of NASCAR returning competition. Well, they don't have fans right now, but they're also creating structures. We have the ability to learn from what's happening literally internationally and domestically in professional leagues as they either return to play or prepare to return to play. And then we have this asset of time that slips by every day that helps us learn how to adapt, how to support what we knew as normal a year ago, and how we prepare for adjustments. I think all of those are better talked about in a full range as opposed to specifying and predicting here's where we're heading.
Greg, last question. I know talking about finances when we're talking about a global health crisis can be awkward, to say the least. So I want to create a little bit of a safe space for you to do just that, because I think we at least have to consider, or at least know, the financial implications if there were no football this year to your conference. Again, I was interested to see Danny White, for example, the athletic director at UCF. He made the argument that it's better to wait until you can put fans fully in the stadium because you're losing a lot of revenue by not having fans in there. What is the financial piece that is staring you in the face? We all know it's never going to overtake the health piece, but what is the financial fact and data point that's kind of staring you in the face that you have to consider as you make all these decisions, because finances are important?
Well, if we look back, we have an opportunity for learning about how we've approached this issue. And that is, in the midst of March, with the SEC basketball tournament, we stopped. We didn't have a debate about finances. We looked at the health implications, the realities around the virus, and made a very clear decision. In fact, our conference stopped competition as we continued to learn. We stopped competition completely well before any announcement on March 12th about NCAA championship disruption. And then we've extended it, and obviously, like others, have stopped the season. There are financial implications to a conference that has, for example, arguably the most highly attended, in fact, not arguably, factually, the most highly attended baseball season, the defending national champions. But at the forefront has been a principle that we're going to be attentive to the health and safety. So you look into the fall, and now we're going to play the, well, what if kind of conversation. Well, I don't know what the fall will look like. We have to be open and honest about that reality. We may not know what the late fall looks like or what next spring looks like. And that's where I think some of the ideas about delay are actually operating from the same lack of information that we observe being present here. If we don't play a sport or multiple sports in the fall, are the financial implications? Absolutely. Absolutely. What do those look like? Well, it depends on how the pandemic and the public health realities play out around that decision making process. And so it's I think all of us are going through this scenario planning I described, which says, okay, some level of normal, and we're going to have efficiencies that have been introduced because that's a responsibility. And then what if there's partial disruption or complete disruption? I think we all have to be thinking about those contingency plans rather than trying to nail down the specifics. We're going to have to react to the reality.
Greg Sankey, thank you for being on the Comeback Pod. I hope it's only a matter of time before I can make you really angry about how many SEC teams should be in the college football playoff, getting back to those debates once again. But we appreciate your time and all your work on this, and best of luck moving forward.
Yeah, I hope it's multiple. And then that leads us into a conversation about how many teams in the NCAA basketball tournament come spring. So it'd be nice to have those realities again. I appreciate the conversation.
It's a date. Thanks, Greg. Appreciate you.
Yeah, take care.
Thanks to Greg Sankey for joining us today. This is The Comeback, presented by The Athletic. Be sure to follow us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you access your podcasts. We're going to be tracking all of these stories, all of these sports, all of these leagues, as they hopefully over the coming weeks and months move back towards getting to the games. Thanks for listening, everybody.